It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
This episode is supported by FX's Clipped, the scandalous story of the 2014 Clippers owner's racist remarks captured on tape and heard around the world. The series charts the tape's impact on a dysfunctional basketball organization striving to win against their reputation as the most cursed team in the league. Starring Lawrence Fishburne, Jackie Weaver, Cleopatra Coleman, and Ed O'Neill. FX's Clipped, streaming June 4th, only on Hulu.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Environmental Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Brian Hamilton of Deerfield Academy, and I'm happy to be joined today by Lindsay Borgon. She's a writer, an oral historian, and a 2018 National Geographic Explorer. Her work has appeared in The Atlantic and The Guardian, among other outlets, and she's here now to talk about her first book. It's called Tree Thieves: Crime and Survival in North America's Woods. And it comes out in paperback today from Little Brown Spark. Lindsay Borgon, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, this is such a fascinating topic, tree poaching, but it also kind of has the air of like a topic that was sort of like environmentalism in the 90s, you know, kind of Captain Planet sort of thing, where we have these, you can imagine this is like, you know, the good environmentalists versus the evil plundering, you know, poachers. And but your book in your hands, there, it's so much more, way more nuanced and complicated than that. And it's really, really such an enticing read. But I wonder, for folks that aren't thinking about poaching in public lands very often, and could you start just giving us a sense of the scale of the problem of timber poaching and how big, you know, the market is and who's buying it? And like, I wonder, like, how likely is it that I've ever come in contact with poached wood, for instance?
Oh, I mean, that's a great question. And I might answer that in two sort of parts. So tree poaching in national parks and in North America, at least, is more common than you might think. So I think the U.S. Forest Service has estimated that it costs them about $20 million a year. You know, in terms of revenue that maybe they would have had themselves had they done the logging themselves. The Park Service doesn't keep stats on this, but you know, it does happen at national parks as well. Sort of countrywide, I suppose. So that's beyond just public lands. So, you know, poaching from private timberlands and other sorts of forests, you know, in all sorts of ways that they're managed, it's actually valued at about $1 billion a year. So it is quite common. The National Park Service says it's a problem in every forest in the United States. Where I live in Canada, in BC alone, I think they valued it at about 20 million, although I might have to revamp that number at some point. it's more common that you might think that people are stealing trees or parts of trees or downed wood or what have you. Globally, it's part of a huge market of international wildlife trade. So timber actually falls underneath this kind of umbrella, and you might think of the wildlife trade as rhino horns and elephant tusks and pangolin scales or the fur of a poached tiger or things like that. Bear gallbladder is a huge one, but timber is right up there. I mean, it is a highly trafficked commodity. It is very valuable. It's often it's often kind of considered on par with like drug trafficking and these kind of much larger organized crime networks. And actually, I think that it's in that format and in that global perspective that it is most likely to enter your home. A lot of us, the wood in our homes is actually not from where we live. And so due to these sorts of like large global systems that we have, you know, it's not unlikely that the wood in your homes is illegal. I mean, there are companies, very recognizable names like IKEA and Home Depot and Gibson Guitar that have been found to be trafficking or selling, found to be selling poached wood. There are various levels of admission to this, you know, like whether they know it or not. But yeah, if it's in your house, it's most likely, you know, not grown in North America, which I think is kind of interesting. Yeah, so that's the scale of it. I mean, it's highly local and highly global at the same time.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And we'll get into some of the murkiness of who knows what, where this stuff is coming from in a few minutes. To follow the architecture of the book, you begin historically, and when my 8-year-old saw the title of your book, Tree Thieves, he said, that sounds like Robin Hood. And indeed, Robin Hood shows up early in the book, which is great.
Good for him. Yes, he's
the king's spear and the king's wood. Yeah. And there's even a great quote you have. It goes further back in time from, Diana Beresford Kroger, the botanist and writer, who says trees and the forest had more legal protections 2,000 years ago in the Celtic world than today. And so I wonder, thinking way back into the medieval and ancient worlds, what from that time and that kind of the long history of forest law do you think is helpful for us to know today to inform policymaking?
Oh, what a great, like, that is such a great question. So, and this is something that really jazzed me when I was writing the book, you know, like my mind was kind of blown because I was learning about, you know, for instance, the Charter of the Forest, which was introduced around the same time as the Magna Carta. And in that sort of era, rights to the forest, rights to using of the forest in particular, were enshrined through the Charter of the Forest, which had to be read out loud on church steps or you know, community squares 4 times a year. And basically, this document outlined the fact that that people had a common right to the spoils of the forest. So that is everything from firewood to, you know, sort of what we would identify now as responsible harvest or sustainable harvest of things like deer or fish, you know, the ability to graze your animals on acorns on the forest floor. Literally was going that specific. And yeah, within that was the sort of outline right that you had the ability to go in and take down wood for firewood or to cut down a tree for building things or to burn to make food, you know, like it really outlined all of these ways that wood has been used. And with the closing of enclosure of the commons, you know, enclosure more broadly, those rights became hotly contested, often ignored, because powerful landowners and the monarchy and what have you came in and enclosed land and removed access of that land from common use. And you know, this is like you're mentioning Robin Hood, so tale as old as time, really. You know, people are upset about that, and they begin poaching. And when I learned about this, I saw some serious parallels to the way that poachers that I was interviewing or kind of learning about were seeing themselves and their own use in today's world. And so I think that we, for very good reason, look at national parks and we say, these are beautiful, unspoiled, public lands that humans are, you know, should not be allowed to touch, to use, to harvest from. But actually, you know, even before the poachers that I was interviewing for this book, I mean, that was land that indigenous peoples were using and stewarding for millennia. And I think that our conservation politics, as you know, they have changed, of course, you know, since the early national parks and forests were formed. But they never really took into account use, the tradition of use, the need for trees, and the fact that there are all sorts of reasons why a tree is useful and beautiful. And it's not always that a tree is beautiful just because it stands. And it's not always that it's useful just in the sort of ecological sense, but that people are part of that wilderness and that they identify and need the woods in ways that that use is a part of, and that common use, you know, we don't really think of it the same way in North America as we might in Europe or England in particular, but it's all kind of wrapped up in that. And so I became really interested in the fact that what I was hearing poachers tell me echoed a lot of essentially commons history from back in medieval time or you know, later. And yeah, so that's why I included that basically in the book, because I thought, you know, not only can you not really ignore Robin Hood when you're talking about poaching, but there's some real interesting precedents in those early times that I think echo today's world.
Yeah, and the book focuses geographically on kind of the stretch of Pacific Northwest from Redwood Country in the Bay Area up through British Columbia, where you're living now, and to look at that early period of kind of the modern conservation politics there in the turn of the 20th century, for instance, you have so many great characters in this book, contemporary and historical. And one of them that I wonder if I could ask you to talk about as sort of to get us into this period here is Enoch Percival French. Who is this fellow? How does he always understand this kind of early period of conservation in Northern California?
Yeah, thank you for asking this. Actually, no one has asked me about Enoch French, but I think of him all the time. Yeah. So Enoch French was one of the first, if not the first, park ranger in a, you know, at the time it was a California state park, in Northern California, in what is now Humboldt County. It wasn't not yet a national park when he became the sort of head of the park there, the head ranger. And you know, Enoch French, and just because I think your listenership will care, I everything I know about him, or a lot of what I know about him, is thankfully from this kind of series of oral history interviews that are held at University of California, Berkeley. And this one woman named Amelia Fry, who if she were still alive, I'd be worshiping at her feet. Cause she did all of these oral history interviews that just anyway, set the ground. So he was a logger before he took on this job, and his dad was a logger, and, you know, part of this real history that's really rooted in the Pacific Northwest of settlers and colonialists, that came west. And they were just logging as they went, you know, and eventually they hit Northern California, the last hill, as they called it, you know, over the last hill, and logging down these last trees. And he got to know this park really well, this region really well. And he was a logger and a tree cruiser before he became the ranger. And a tree cruiser is responsible, works for a company or possibly the state, and is responsible for essentially valuing how much timber is in a specific region. So, you know, they get their sort of coordinates of where they're going, and they walk around and essentially use methods to measure up trees and say, this has a million board feet worth in it. So you get a sense of the financial value that way. And then he became in charge of protecting these trees, you know, which I think is really part of the complicated history of this region and every sort of forested region, which is that many families end up somewhere to extract and then may end up protecting in the wake of that extraction. And but what really interested in me and him is not only his amazing stories, because he had like 1,000, but the fact that he admitted in one of these interviews, you know, he was like, yeah, when I was a logger, or even when I was like an early day ranger, sure, I'd go out into the park and take down a tree if I needed one. You know, sure, I knew how to take that down and to harvest firewood and like way back in the day, kind of like put it in the river and you know, have a boom and transport it down to where I needed to use it. And so here you had somebody who really lived at the confluence of this contemporary conflict that I was writing about, which is that, you know, the ranger versus the poacher, the logging family versus the park, somebody who loves the environment and has benefited from its destruction, all happening at once, like through this man. And what compelled me about him was that he never really, in these interviews, he never really tried to justify one side or the other. Like, they both existed at the same time within him, and he wasn't sometimes I think, like, okay, so for instance, in the past, I've done oral history interviews with former whalers. So, you know, whaling ended in 1963, like relatively recently. And so a lot of those whalers I interviewed, you know, they felt the need to say to me, like, I do feel guilt now, you know, or I apologize now, or I do feel bad now. And that's fine, that's within their right. But Enoch French was not apologizing either way. And I thought that was really interesting, right? Like, he didn't feel at the time of his interview that he was wrong in either side. And so, you know, again, he just very, very coastal person in that way. He lived with that conflict within him.
I will get to your contemporary reporting, which is the heart of the book, but if you'll indulge me one more historical
question. Yeah, please, as much as that. I'm happy to talk about it because I think the book has benefited from having, like, quite a catchy contemporary element to it, but, like, the history is what made me think it could be a book, right? Is doing all of the research and realizing not only does poaching have this, like, crazy past and fascinating political kind of implications, that this has been going on for forever. And the poachers that you hear about now, like, they walk in the steps of poachers from hundreds and hundreds of years ago.
Totally. Obviously, a really canonical event in recent history in the 80s here was the Timber Wars in the Pacific Northwest. And then you also enlightened me to learn about the Canadian kind of corollary, or the war in the woods. It's called in British Columbia. And it's always, this is a really canonical event in kind of my upbringing, as far as, you know, kind of getting us our dead end jobs versus the environment sort of politics of the late 80s and 90s that I kind of came up with. But at the same time, poaching wasn't itself at the heart of that necessarily. There was a tiny owl and other things at the heart of it. But kind of how do we think about these moments if we look through a lens of poaching?
Yeah. So when I first started hearing about poaching, tree poaching in particular, I want to say, I mean, there's poaching all sorts of other plant life and animals. I had a Google alert set up as I do. And I was like, okay, this is happening in Washington and Northern California and sometimes in Oregon. Like, I could just see these trends coming in and, into my inbox, and I was reading about it, and I started doing interviews, with, you know, kind of starting generally with investigators and rangers and people on the law enforcement side of things, because at first I thought that would be my narrative through line. And none of them said this to be cruel or harsh, but, you know, I would say, why is this happening in Oregon or wherever? And they would say, we just have a lot of poverty here. We have a lot of poverty. If you look at where this, if you look at where these crimes are taking place, it's around these old former mill towns. We have towns that are economically depressed, that are socially struggling, and that's where this is happening. They were not wrong. And so, you know, you start asking yourself, like, how did we get to this point? I also knew from reading about poaching and then also eventually hearing it from poachers themselves that one of the motivations for poaching was not simply money, but resentment and anger toward conservation structures. You know, it wasn't really voiced to me that way. You know, it'd always be like, the park, we hate the park, we hate the federal government. And I was like, okay, well, where is this coming from? You know, particularly with the younger poachers, and really realizing that they had grown up in families and communities that were at the center of this conflict, that for years they lived in communities that relied on resource extraction. And those communities were portrayed particularly in the media or within other circles as backward and wrong and maybe stupid, you know? Like there was a lot of rhetoric around the type of people that lived there and the type of work that they did and why they did it. And that might be lingering. You know, that was kind of my hypothesis or my question was, how much does anger from this moment in history have a role in what's happening now? And so I followed that through, and you know, for some of the people, it was the main driver. For other people, it was just part of what they grew up with. You know, so you'd say like, do you remember the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, and what it was like in this town? Yeah, it was bad. You know, I remember my uncles being mad all the time, for instance, right? Like that's the type of feedback I was hearing. So it was kind of this, both of those inroads from the timber wars that really interest me. So not just like the trickle down effect of what happens to small communities when their only source of income is either phased out or just immediately halted, and also the emotional aspect.
It was supposed to go differently, right? I mean, your book has so much to offer us in thinking about post-industrial places and bridging the past and the present. You show, for instance,
sorry to interrupt you, but when you say it was supposed to go differently, I think that's really interesting because was it? Like, I don't know how much that was on the radar. I don't know how much that was like actually explored.
I was struck by the echo around in the past and the present around the promise of tourism, right? That even back in the city of the Redwoods League, they were saying, you know, that we'll have public money that'll help the loggers out after we stop letting them log until such time as which the tourist income is so high that they don't need that anymore. And then you show in the 100 economists signing the pledge that became part of the 2022 biodiversity conference, the COP15 there, the UN's thing, saying, you know, we're going to preserve 30% of the world's land and water. But it'll be fine because the ecotourism will essentially be a huge new source of revenue. And you write very beautifully about how Orrick, California, this census designated place, you know, is one of the most breathtakingly beautiful places in the world. And yet, you know, there's not the kind of infrastructure you would have expected to see there for a tourist town. Why didn't it come to pass? What are the barriers we don't think of when we think about ecotourism as the future? I don't know.
Well, first of all, service economies do not pay as well as resource economies, and they never will with the way that we're going now. And so it's one thing to say that, and it's another thing to imply or to believe that working a retail job is going to pay you as much as even working 4 months out of the year on a resource economy. It doesn't work out that way. Asking people to rely on tips, for instance, is not going to allow them to like live a life that perhaps their parents or grandparents or whoever was living. I think that something that maybe what, and this is me, this is my, just my own opinion, because I think some historians might differ here. I think that the fact that the tourism in Washington, Oregon, and Northern California is highly centralized around Highway 101, makes it actually easier for people to just drive through places and not have to stop. It's pretty easy to just go, wow, how beautiful, and that's it. You know, I think you hear this a lot, and yeah, you mentioned the sort of 30 by 2030 pledge. There's also just anytime you hear about any sort of deindustrialization, like I'm from a place in Canada, I live in BC, but I'm from a province called Alberta, which is, you know, people call it the Texas of Canada. It's oil and gas, right? Oil and gas. And when it's particularly northern Alberta. And so a lot of those communities, I think, have already been kind of encouraged to diversify their tourism. And I just think, you can do that, but I think that's unfair to them. You know, I think that these communities deserve more than just being told, like, don't worry, people will want to come here. It's like, it's not that simple, right? And it's not that easy to get to. It's the same as Northern California. It isn't that, like, anyway, I'm going off on a tangent here. But I just think that, yeah, the promise of tourism has been consistent across economies, you know, across particularly resource economies. When we talk about detransition, consistently through history, those people are told, it's beautiful here, and people will want to come visit. And it very rarely works out that way. You know, I think it's, let's try and think together somewhere whose economy has been totally saved by tourism. No, I'm not sure. Yeah, I'm telling you.
I want to come back to this too when we get into some of the characters in your story. But to zoom back a little bit and to think about your initial kind of entry into the topic with thinking about law enforcement and following around law enforcement. One of the things you get reading this book is just, I mean, just some sense of like, how do they ever catch any poachers? How does any, I mean, poaching seems incredibly hard. I mean, you can have any kind of law you want, but how do you actually make it? How do you enforce it? And so, you know, what are some of the things that make poaching so difficult? Catching poachers and enforcing these laws so difficult?
Wow. Okay. So if you want to think about it in terms of the communities that this tends to kind of orbit around, so they are farmer logging communities, usually. Most poaching happens at night in the forest. Almost all poaching happens at night by people that have lived in those communities for their entire lives. And so those are folk that know paths in that the rangers might not know. They, in the case of Oryk, they knew a ranger's schedules. They knew, you know, because it's such a small town that you can kind of, like, if you're interested in doing this crime, you're watching people come and go. You're getting a sense of, okay, at this time of night, they've only got three people working. And so, you know, they always have to have two people there. So it's going to be less likely that they find me. Okay, so if I'm a poacher, I go in at night. I know where I'm going because I've scoped it out, because I spend so much time in the woods that I know, like, where a really good log is. And I know where burrow, for instance, I know where the trail is that leads to it. I know what sort of equipment I need to take it down. I have access to a truck and a driver, most likely. And I think the kind of crucial element in how it's hard to catch them is that it's both difficult to find a crime scene, and then by the time you have, which is often through luck, that product, that the stolen item has already been sold and disappeared. So you're trying to match the stolen goods to the crime scene itself, and that is really, really hard. So most poaching sites are found, like I said, by accident, by people that have stumbled upon it while on a hike, while doing research. In most cases, okay, you and I are out there and we notice that there's a stump that wasn't there the last time we walked this trail, and we know that it's in the park and it shouldn't have been taken. So maybe we go to the park office and we say, I want to report this. They go out, they take all the information that they need from you, and they're going to start thinking, okay, if it was a redwood that was taken, where is this likely to go? And who do we know in the surrounding area that might have taken it? And really, they rely on informants. That ends up being the sort of tool in their tool chest that's really going to help them out the most. Because the chances that the wood has already been moved is really high.
And even in many cases, once it's milled, it's
yeah. I mean, if you think about it, how do you match grain to grain? It's very difficult. There is a case in the book where they did that, which is quite amazing, right? So they went to a barrel shop, or like a wood artisan wood shop, and they took a photo, and then they drove back and walked the trail to the poaching site, and they were like, "This grain matches this grain." That happened once, though, you know,
right.
That's not every single time. So
exception is the rule, yeah,
exactly. And so law enforcement has been, park rangers have really been trying all these different methods to figure this out. So they hide, you know, I think they've done sort of studies where they've plotted out where poaching cases like have taken place, and then they've gone into the woods and looked for like what they would see as high value wood, and they put cameras facing those trees to kind of, you know, hopefully catch somebody in the act or to dissuade somebody, because it is very common that poachers will know that the cameras are there, and or they put motion detected rumble strips essentially under the ground that will that when a vehicle drives over it will alert them. But I think those are flashy and cool, but the informant system is what has borne out as actually working. So, yeah.
One of the facts that will stick with me from the book is that compared with FBI agents and border control agents, Forest Service agents stand a risk, have a higher risk of physical violence on the job, or, you know, park rangers.
Particularly in Redwoods, which is considered one of the most dangerous parks in for various reasons. But yeah, they are second to FBI officers in terms of danger.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
What did you learn about spending time with them? What did you learn about the kind of people that choose to do this work?
On the ranger front? Yeah. You know, it's really interesting because particularly in the context of the National Park System, that is a federal agency. And so actually, just to rewind a little bit, I mean, most likely you and I, are thinking of park rangers maybe a little bit stereotypically, and we're thinking of a tan uniform and a tri-point hat, and they're friendly, they have a friendly reputation in our circles, and they're like, welcome to this amazing place. Do you have any questions about where the spotted owl, or, you know, like these amazing, like the sequoias? And please let me know, you know, like they're just like a friendly thing, and they might like sell you your camping spot or something like that, you know. They are law enforcement, so rangers are armed. Not all of them. When they apply, from what I understand, when you apply to become a park ranger, you choose if you want to go the educational or the law enforcement route. And the park rangers that I got to know in Redwoods, you know, they carried AR-15s and they carried in their trucks, they had those, and then on their hips, they had, you know, sort of cop weaponry, so like pepper spraying, batons, and things. And they wore bulletproof vests, and they patrolled the, you know, like in big trucks, or not big, in trucks, the way that you might patrol like a police officer. And they investigate things that happen in the park, and they monitor what's going on in the park. And I think that is a difference. That difference in employment is one thing for you and I as visitors to the park. But if you live in a park community, that's a big part of your understanding of what the park is doing. And so in Oreck, this town in Northern California, they saw park rangers as monitoring them, and they saw them as patrolling the town like law enforcement. And they saw them as pulling them over, you know, if they suspected that they might have wood in their trunk, searching their cars and things like that. And so I think that's important. The rangers that I got to know, and I just, you know, always want to put out that I really respected them. And they were honest, and they wanted to talk about the challenges of things that are going on in the backwoods of this land that they're trusted with. And they have a really impossible job, which is that, like, there's a highway that goes through Redwoods, for instance, but Redwoods itself stretches much further back from that. It's impossible for them to patrol that land, even like by foot or by truck or in any way, and they're in charge of it. That's really hard. And people do stuff on that land that is dangerous and illegal. At the same time, they can get search warrants to enter people's homes, and they can be intimidating. That's for sure. And I think, you know, something that was really interesting that was brought up to me by a poacher is that often they're just not from the area, and they tend not to live in the gateway communities. So Oryk is a town right on the southern edge of Redwoods, and it's a gateway community. You have to drive through it to get into the park. And the rangers are not living there. They're not part of the community there often anyway. One of the rangers who I followed was from Northern California. He wasn't technically from that town, but the superintendent, who was a lovely person, you know, he was from the East Coast. He worked in Philadelphia. He worked at Shenandoah National Park, and he transferred in, and it was his job to manage the problems of the park, you know, in quotes. And I think that there was a certain impatience with the fact that he just wasn't from there, you know. And he had been transferred in like any other sort of public servant, and asked to do something that was actually a really local problem, that he, I mean, that's impossible. It's an impossible task, right? So I understood, the misgivings around sort of the approach that the Park Service as an organization was taking to solve the problem. They're law enforcement. There's actually a pretty interesting history of, you know, I this was my own sort of ignorance going into this, but because I've had one experience at parks, right? And I mean, there's history of park rangers kind of roughing up folks in Yosemite or Yellowstone, and, you know, having a very narrow view of what is allowed to happen on public land, and using force to enforce that. Yeah.
One of the latest tools that you chronicle the development of in trying to combat poaching is DNA testing and mass spectrometry, which, and I couldn't decide reading the book whether this is like, what a cool solution to this very difficult problem, or whether this is just an absurd kind of attempt to sort of solve an unsolvable problem. And I just, if you could say a bit about kind of the origins of these technologies, and are they, you know, how big a role do you expect them to play in the future?
I think that they can play a really important role in the global trade in particular, because there's a really massive challenge there, which is that the wood that you and I might use to build our deck is ending up in Home Depot where we buy it, but, you know, it's going through ports where it's already been milled and put into shipping containers, and like, how is a border agent meant to look at that wood and say, I think that might be illegally harvested from Peru? You know, like, it's like way too much to ask from one person in one organization. And this is something that DNA testing and mass spec, as I call it, and those databases that they're developing can really narrow in on. As poaching continues in North America, there is a real hope that the database will also kind of, you know, hold important information of these sort of North American species that are traded. So redwood, Douglas fir, cedar, eastern walnut, black walnut, oaks, some oaks, the tulip tree. Those are relatively small parts of the trade, and I don't think that there's an appetite on the sort of local front to invest too much in getting that done. And I don't really know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. I know that like there's a real focus on just these highly traded international species, I think what's interesting about it is, you know, I think in the book I detail Rich Cron and how he was a big, he is a scientist at a laboratory in Corvallis, Oregon, and he was able to testify at a hearing because a tree poacher in Washington State had actually started an absolutely massive forest fire through his actions. And he was a tree poacher, not unlike, you know, like quote unquote small time kind of poacher, who started this entire kind of environmental crisis through what he did. And tree DNA was able to essentially convict him for starting that crime. For starting that fire. So, I mean, it's not that it's useless in North America, but I think in terms of the trade of wood itself and not these other sort of broader crimes, I'm not sure what the appetite is to like really focus on North American species in that way. So unless something happens where all of a sudden there's just like a tree that's grown here that's just like insanely valuable, you know, I'm sure that would change things a little bit.
And in the book, you follow the commodity chain to South America and to Peru. And what did you learn from that travel that helps you inform this study?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I learned a ton. I think it was important for me to do that because as much as I was really interested in these small local stories, like you can't really talk about poaching if you're not going to talk about what's going on in the global South, because that is mass deforestation and illegal logging on a scale that we just don't know here. And also, I think it's interesting because most of our products come from that logging as opposed to local wood. And so, in a sense, that's we can actually do more on that scale than at home. And so, I went down and I was doing interviews about experiences of timber poaching and experiences of sort of land grabs, I suppose, in the Peruvian Amazon. I write in the book that something that really sticks out to me now and then is that the motivations for tree poaching or timber poaching in both places really echoed one another. And so the poaching off land in Peru, when I was asking people, why is this happening? The answer was almost always money. People know, you know, this is people that need work, that need income, and they know how to use a chainsaw. They feel comfortable with it, and they know where to take it, and they need money to live as much as you and I do. And, you know, that's exactly what I was hearing in Oreck and Forks, Washington, and these other places. And so, in particular, I actually was shown that the poachers were no longer there. They had been caught and tried already, but I was able to go out to a poaching site in the Amazon, and they were showing me this sort of tent encampment that was there. And I looked at it, and then later, I came back to North America, I'd taken my notes, and then I went out on a patrol with these BC resource officers, and they were like, here, we're going to show you this tent encampment where poachers are living. And I was like, this looks very similar to what I saw in Peru. The species of tree is different, but here you have technically squatters living on public land or private land, cutting down trees and taking it into the mill. And it just, you know, I thought here we have this echo, you know, of motivation and sadness in the socioeconomic situation. I think in Peru, people were telling me, you know, we have all these economic migrants that are coming into Peru, and a lot of people know how to log, and they just kind of come in and they set up camp and they start working logging here. And I mean, I find it very hard to fault any poacher that's doing that, you know, because nobody's doing that because they want to, really.
You opened the book with an epigraph from the great Raymond Williams on kind of the intertwined human and culture and the impossibility of pulling those things apart. And you can, in your conclusion, you have this great line where you say that separating nature from human use has never kept it safe. And so I wonder here, looking back, then what does a forest conservation that doesn't rely on that dichotomy between nature and culture, that isn't fortress conservation, what would that look like?
Yeah, I think it looks different all over the world. And actually, I'm hoping to explore this more in the future. But I do write about community forests at the end of the book there. You know, I'm always cautioned to say, like, I don't think there's like a perfect solution. But I think there's a community forest in my community. And the idea behind this was that it was once logging land. And rather than the province engulfing it into a provincial park, for instance, the community where I live bought it. It's managed by a board. And when you go into this forest, you know, there's paths, there's a river that runs through it. There are stumps because there is selective logging that happens. And there's like a university research station that operates out of this land. And so you have three uses all happening at once. And they, you know, they have responsibilities, or they outline their own responsibility, which is that if there's a tree that needs to be taken down for whatever reason, they hire local people to do that. The proceeds from the, you know, so that local people are being paid directly for this skill, because I live in a former mill town and the mill has, you know, very slowly shut down. And, you know, I'll give you one guess as to what they thought will replace it in our economy, which is tourism. And, you know, but I mean, there's a lot of people around town that like made their careers and built their homes and moved here because they worked in the woods, and they drove a logging truck and they drove those logs to the mill outside town every day. And that mill might be closed down, but those folks are still here. And so the community forest kind of gives certainly not the same amount of security as those mill jobs maybe at one time did, but it still allows people to use those skills to do what they like to do. Some, you know, if you need firewood, which is a really big part of why people poach for their own use. It's also a big part of life in the Pacific Northwest and other places. There are a lot of people in my town that heat their homes by wood. That is their primary source of heating. And you know, you can apply for a permit to go harvest your firewood. And you're not going to get arrested for it, which I think is kind of an interesting, you know, point of view, I guess. But there's, you know, but I try to counter that by saying there's a community forest, you know, a couple hours west of me that had a poaching problem. So they knew that there were people in the community that were poaching from the area. But you know, what I think is interesting is that when I called them and I was like, okay, so you have poaching happening, it's happening all along this road. And they said, well, you know, the thing is that we know who's doing it, and we approached them and we offered that if they want to approach the wood, they should just ask, or if they want to take the wood, they need to just ask us and they can take it. And we think that that will work differently. And I was like, oh yeah. So, you know, you immediately don't arrest them. I feel like that might be one part of it, is that, you know, you're not like going right away to like, and we're going to charge you and we're going to, you know, you'll have like whatever, like illegal harvest on your record. You know, they just said, we approached them because we know who they are and we know why they need it. We said, why don't you come on this day and take what you need instead of coming in the dead of night and taking the same thing? And so, you know, that's a little bit more flexible problem solving than a government agency can do, you know, because if you think about it, the systems that we have with federal and state level conservation, they'd have to be approved on so many different levels where they can just go up to somebody and say, hey, don't do that anymore. Hey, like, I know that you need that, but let's figure out another way.
The hardcover version of the book came out last year. I'm curious what the reception has been like in the places you wrote about and beyond.
Yeah, it's a good question. I've heard from a few of the people in the book who have been very supportive and have been kind. I've heard from some folk who were not too happy about it, which is kind of part of the deal. But overall, I've just been really thankful that people seem to have been interested in what, you know, this story I was trying to tell and these ideas that I'm trying to put out there. And I've been very thankful for that. And yeah, Creek Beats has done way better than I ever expected it would do, just because, you know, to me, this was for a long time my kind of funny obsession with why people took trees and why people poached, and yeah, like Robin Hood and all of these sort of funny, weird, you know what it's like. It's when you get into something historical that you're like, you can't let go of, and people are looking at you kind of like, oh my God, she's obsessed, you know. And I am and was obsessed with like people taking trees from like the King's Forest in the 1700s, and like the fact that they had to go to a special like forest court and all of this stuff. And thankfully I have, you know, heard from readers who were really into it. And that has been my favorite part by far, is just people have come up to me at like festivals or, you know, events or whatever, and they just said, oh, I'm really into this, and like, do you know about this historical thing? And like being able to nerd out it fills your heart, you know, where you're just like, yeah, I love this too. Kind readers are the point of it. But in terms of the reception, yeah, it's been interesting. Like in terms of the sources themselves, it's been
Sure. Yeah. Well, I hope the paperback gets you lots more readers and to nerd out with and all that. When your schedule allows you to, I wonder if there are any current or future projects you're willing to preview for us before I let you
go? Yeah. Well, I'm going back into my weird sort of, you know, I was saying that I'm arranged to, or that I'm following these ideas of community conservation. And again, because I'm a bit of a odd duck, so I'm interested in the clearances, the Scottish clearances, if you've done any reading on that. And I don't know how much time we have for me to get into this, but anyway, there's a law in Scotland or sort of act called the Land Reform Act. And it was when Scotland gained independence, they devolved from Westminster. And this was one of the big acts that they put forward, which is essentially, it's land reform. And it comes in the wake of understanding that that colonial history in Scotland removed people from the land that they had traditionally crofted and farmed and fished. And it allows communities to buy back land that had been taken from them in that era, if they can come up with this sort of assessed value. And so a lot of communities have bought back hunting estates or frankly entire mountains or entire hills and things like this, and they manage them community focused rather than just a single owner. And so because I'm really into the commons and dispossession and kind of people's relationship historically with the land that they're from, and this idea of use developing a relationship and all of that, I could go on and on. It's like how do we have reparations for like environmental crimes that were technically crimes but like environmental dispossession in the past, and is there any way that we can actually address, like look at it and see it for what it was and address it? Can the law help us with that? I don't know. You know, anyway, asking all of these questions, that's where I'm going at the moment. But it's very it's still a sort of glob in my brain. It's not very formed yet.
It's a very exciting glob. Did you hear that, Scottish land reform nerds? Get ready for this project. Yep, reach out.
My email is on my website. Please reach out to me because, I'm in the thick of it. I got some plans for some field work, and I'm deep in my reading, as you do. I think it actually applies beyond just Scotland. You know, I think we're hearing these questions all the time now. There was an injustice, there is and a continued injustice, and is there a way to make it right, or do we just kind of live with it as the way things are? And here's one way that one small country is thinking about it, and maybe that can be applied to other places as well. So anyway, yeah,
so compelling and okay, so enticing.
Thanks.
But for the time being, we will satisfy ourselves with this book, which is called Tree Thieves: Crime and Survival in North America's Woods. It comes out in paperback today from Little Brown Spark, and its author is, and my guest has been, Lindsay Borgon. Lindsay, thank you so much for your time and for this book.
Thank you for having me.